Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. Along with Steve Goldstein, I'm Mark Brody. Sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon today. Look for a high of 80 degrees, 10 degrees warmer than average. It'll be clear tonight with overnight lows in the mid-50s. More of the same for tomorrow. Sunny skies with a high of 82 degrees. It's 77 right now.
For many parents, the decision to vaccinate is a frightening one, but instead of skipping vaccines altogether, some parents are opting to follow a modified schedule. But as KJZZ's Kathy Ritchie reports, there are risks to this pick-and-choose approach.
Dr. Amy Shoptow is a pediatrician who took an oath to do no harm. But when it comes to the topic of vaccines, it's a balancing act. On one hand, by accepting patients who've chosen not to vaccinate their child, there's a risk that child could become sick with a vaccine-preventable disease, walk into her practice, and unwittingly infect another child. On the other hand, by accepting these parents, it's a chance to maybe convince them that vaccines are safe.
I have many parents that'll come in with a piece of paper that says, 2 months I only want to get the DTaP, and at 4 months of age, I want to get the Prevnar, and then they'll go on with a schedule. And what I do is I, talk to them about the cons of that, the risk of it, actually, of giving a vaccine schedule that is not following the CDC.
Shoptow says some parents believe the CDC's vaccine schedule is too much, that too many vaccines can overwhelm a young immune system. But she says there's no science backing up that claim.
It's kind of like playing Russian roulette. Okay, I'll get the pertussis vaccine, but how do you know you're going to be exposed to pertussis and not be exposed to pneumococcal or Haemophilus influenza?
And that's a challenge with modifying a vaccine schedule that has been repeatedly studied and deemed safe. Kathy Ritchie, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Governor Doug Ducey this week announced Apple would take the Mesa facility that had been used by one of its contractors to make sapphire glass and turn it into a global command center. Details of that deal are now starting to emerge. KJZZ's business correspondent Christina Hansen has been crunching the numbers and joins me now. Hi, Christina.
Hi there.
So let's remember how we got here. What had this building been used for and why did it fail?
It was previously a manufacturing facility where Apple's contractor named GT Advanced Technologies was making sapphire glass material for the next generation iPhone, the iPhone 6. But problems arose pretty much from the start, and less than a year later, GT filed for bankruptcy and ultimately laid off 700 workers in Mesa.
So do we know what this center will be now and what the people who work there will be doing?
Yeah, it'll be what's called a global command center. Basically, whenever you open an app on your iPhone or iPad, that information goes to the cloud. And Apple has all these data centers all over the place to help manage all of that. I spoke to State Senator Bob Worsley. He drafted some tax breaks for Apple last year, and he also met with Apple executives over Super Bowl weekend when they were here to renegotiate the deal. Here's his explanation of where the Mesa facility fits in.
It'll basically manage any data centers that they own or they have contractors that run, and load balance all the traffic in the world that's up in the cloud.
So, Christina, Apple had been in line for about $10 million worth of incentives from the Arizona Commerce Authority, but it appears now that won't happen. Why is that?
Well, according to Senator Worsley, it was Apple's idea. Now, remember, those incentives were contingent on things like job creation. And with Apple's new direction for the facility, the number of permanent jobs went from about 700 to 150.
They still came in and said, we know there's not going to be as many employees as we thought, and so we're relinquishing these credits back to the state.
But there are still some deal sweeteners on the table, yes?
Yes, several. Apple already gets a big break on property taxes there because it's in a foreign trade zone. Lawmakers also approved some other tax breaks last year worth at least $25 million. Those incentives were specifically for manufacturing, but now that that facility is not going to be a manufacturing facility anymore, a group of Republicans introduced a bill just this week that would tweak the law so Apple could still get those incentives.
So obviously there are some critics who think tax incentives are a waste of money and have government playing favorites. Did that conversation change at all after almost losing Apple for a second time?
Well, Worsley told me that Apple had narrowed it down to Arizona and one other state for this global command center, which is why Apple executives flew here over the weekend. Now, keep in mind two things. One, Apple has a reputation for saying, we'll go somewhere else to get the best possible incentive package. And two, remember that this time around, Arizona wasn't trying to get Apple here. It was trying to keep Apple here because Apple actually owns that facility outright. So some would argue Apple shouldn't get similar incentives with less job creation, especially since it's already here. But people like Worsley say having Apple here is a feather in Arizona's cap and really puts us on the map.
KJZZ's business correspondent, Christina Hansen. Christina, thanks.
Thank you.
The NFL season officially ended on Sunday with the Super Bowl, and the Patriots have had their victory parade in Boston, but there are still some signs of the big game and the events that led up to it around downtown Phoenix. Jack Groh is the director of the NFL's environmental program and stays behind after the Super Bowl to deal with parts of the cleanup.
The final breakdown is going on downtown now. They're removing barriers, but the thing I'm most interested in is they're tearing down all the decor, the fabric, the vinyl banners, all the decorations that were put up for Super Bowl. And there's miles of stuff down there. The bike barricades that you saw, the bike barricade covers, all that stuff is coming down now.
Does that include some of the building wraps, some of the sponsored stuff, like on the light rail stations, all that stuff?
Yeah, that stuff is coming down as well. Pretty much everything that's downtown is it's got to be put back the way it was before Super Bowl got here.
So who does all that?
Well, there are crews who handle all that. Usually there are contractors who take care of the breakdown part of it. There's a lot of disassembly that goes on, too. And you'll see there's cranes down there, and there's a lot of heavy equipment, too, taking things down. My job is a little different from theirs. My job is to coordinate between the folks that are tearing down and all the local community groups that we've identified as recipients of materials that are being taken down.
Are you talking about raw materials, or are there in some instances like a stage that somebody might get to use as a stage?
Well, things like staging and metal construction and that stuff, that's always reused. That goes to a storage place and is reused by the contractors, the event managers who put that up. But all the what we kind of refer to as soft goods, those are all, again, fabric and vinyl and mesh and all that stuff comes down. And there's a lot of uses for this stuff. We've been doing this for, gosh, almost 20 years. We've been repurposing materials from Super Bowl. It used to be a lot harder than it is now because, for instance, here in Phoenix, we've got four really good local community groups that we're working with. All of them have different missions, different needs, but between them, there's hardly anything that we're taking down that they can't find a repurpose for.
So what kinds of uses do those groups have for some of the materials that were used at Super Bowl Central, the experience, maybe at the stadium itself as well?
Well, it varies by organization. So the four we're working with this year are Keep Phoenix Beautiful. We're working with Treasures for Teachers. We're also working with Salvation Army, and we're working with Stardust Building. So all of them have different things they can use. For example, a lot of the vinyl and fabric and mesh that's coming down is going over to Keep Phoenix Beautiful. They've got a 15-acre urban farm here up by Indian School, and they're in urgent need of shade coverings, of shade structures. So a lot of that stuff will make excellent shade structures, shade covers for them. And with 15 acres, they can use a lot of material. And to be able to get the material at no cost is a tremendous benefit for them.
So they'll have banners that say, like, Super Bowl 49 and, you know, Verizon, Super Bowl Central, stuff like that, like reflecting the sun off their crops, huh?
Yeah, Tom Waldeck over at Keep Phoenix Beautiful was joking about that. He said, if we bring Super Bowl back here, you know, 6, 7, 8 years from now, he said, you'll be able to fly in town and see Super Bowl banners from the air because they're going to have these huge pieces laid out there. So, yeah, I mean, it's a good reuse. Everybody has different stuff, though. Treasures for Teachers, for instance, they're taking an awful lot of office supplies and office equipment. Stardust, I think, is looking at mostly carpeting.
What is the timeline like for this kind of work? The game obviously was on Sunday, so yeah. When do you start tearing stuff down, and when do you expect to be finished?
Well, some of the teardown actually started a week before because we had Pro Bowl, and so there was some Pro Bowl elements that had to come down right afterwards. The real big teardown, though, starts right away. It starts the first thing Monday morning and goes on. It'll take, roughly a week and a half to 2 weeks to get everything finished and everything cleared.
Jack Groh directs the NFL's environmental program.
The group Local First Arizona wants to help businesses in the state buy more products and services from other Arizona companies. The Source AZ program includes a free audit to look at where a business's biggest expenditures are. The group then uses its database to try to find similar products sold by Arizona companies.
Local First Arizona's founder and director, Kimber Lanning, says her group did a study with Copper Point Mutual Insurance several years ago and found it could save a lot of money by buying its products closer to home. She says the firm now sources 84% of its goods and services locally. Scottsdale-based company then measured the impact of that change.
The first thing we found is they spent $100 million, but it had a $500 million impact on Arizona's economy by the time those dollars stayed and recirculated throughout all those different jobs and companies. But secondly, despite the fact that they employ 518 people, we proved that they're indirectly supporting 3,600 Arizona jobs. Those 3,600 jobs are in manufacturing and medical supplies and all those other types of industries that they're supporting through their spending. So the idea for Source AZ came, what if we had Arizona's top 100 employers thinking differently about what their role is within the context of a healthy economy? If we could get big companies, medium-sized companies, and smaller companies thinking about how they're sourcing their goods and services, we could make a direct impact on Arizona's overall budget. But secondly, Arizona's unemployment rate.
Is there sort of, in your mind, an ideal percent of goods and services that a business should be sourcing locally?
It's different for every type of company. It's going to be easier for some companies and not so easy for others. But we believe that when you look at the day-to-day things like insurance, office supplies, if you know, we were able to get a lot of companies to switch actual products that they source, like cups or plates or napkins, those types of things. But some things get harder and harder. One of the things we really like to look at is banking. If we can get more Arizona companies banking with Arizona community banks, then their deposits will be recirculated at a higher rate out in the form of loans, which increases capital for our business community.
Are there certain services or products that you just can't do locally? I mean, there are things that Arizona just doesn't provide?
Oh, certainly. The buy local movement really does come in tiers. If you can't find it locally, find it regionally. If you can't find it regionally, find it nationally. There are certain things that aren't even manufactured in America anymore, and there's nothing we can do about that. And we're certainly not hysterically watching every single dollar, but if we all link arms and think a little bit differently about how the economy works, we can make a huge difference. Too often, the buy local movement we get focused on, is it from Arizona? When in reality, what we're talking about is supporting independent businesses in a way that when you spend your money there, they in turn are supporting the jobs of a graphic designer or a web developer or an accountant, etc. When you support a company that has replicated the same chain over and over and over again, you could have 30,000 locations. They're still only going to have one accountant. They're going to have one graphic designer. They're going to have one web developer.
What kinds of things will companies have trouble sourcing locally?
So there's industry-specific things, such as we worked with Clean Air Cab, and they have a machine in the cabs that swipes credit cards that is not manufactured locally, and there's nothing you can do about that. But then there's everyday things like gasoline. There are a handful of local gasoline sellers here in Arizona, but clearly that's not something that's coming from Arizona.
Do you expect a lot of companies to take you up on this?
We do. We believe that a lot of Arizona companies don't realize the impact they can make. And they're also supporting companies that are growing government. Once a business understands, if I'm spending money with companies that don't offer health care benefits for their employees, and those employees end up on the state's health care program, and that they're actually paying for that through their taxes, once people start to put that together, I think a lot of them will say, hey, we can do better than this. And I also think it's important to note that with Copper Point Mutual, they actually saved 1.3% on their total budget after they made the switch. So what we're really working against here is millions of dollars of advertising over the last 20 years that's told everybody that bigger is cheaper. And we're here to say, let's research that. Maybe it is sometimes, but maybe it's not.
Kimber Lanning is the founder and director of Local First Arizona. Look out, Serial. You now have some podcasting competition courtesy of a Southern Arizona town.
Welcome to Marana's Your Town Podcast. This podcast is a service of the town of Marana, and each episode features informative commentary on newsworthy topics from across the community.
This episode, featuring the town's Parks and Rec Director, is the third Marana has produced. Rodney Campbell, the town's public information officer and podcast host, says the show started late last year with a discussion about an outlet mall that'll be built in Marana.
We started doing this podcast as a way to reach out to our audiences in ways that we hadn't done so far. We started up with social media way back in 2009 with Facebook and Twitter pages, and we were among the first municipalities in our area down here in Southern Arizona to do that. We've since added YouTube pages. We have gone in and updated our website a couple times. We've done a lot of video work, obviously, to tie into the YouTube account. And we were trying to think of different ways to reach audiences, and a podcast just seemed like a natural way of doing it.
Do you have a sense of how many people have downloaded it or listened to it?
Yeah, in fact, I was just looking at the numbers this morning. We were up to 994 plays on our first two episodes. The first one was about the Marana Center, which is going to be a part of the Marana Center is a outlet mall. The second episode that we published a week later was an interview with our police chief about a new facility that our police department could be building here in the next couple of years here on our municipal complex campus.
Do you feel that there are things that you can do with a podcast that you can't do with some of your other outreach efforts? And maybe are there some limitations of this medium that you don't face with some of those other outlets?
Well, certainly the limitations are you can't do anything visual with it. That was the big advantage with doing videos. And this isn't to say that we won't do videos anymore. It's just that we really aren't doing as many right now as we were doing toward the beginning of in the middle of last year. And that's what the podcast is filling that gap. You know, the good thing about the podcast is that we try to keep them pretty conversational. The subjects we've covered so far have been things that are of great interest to the community, and there's a lot more coming up down the road now that we think will also really appeal to our audience. I mean, our community is at about 42,000 residents now. There's always something going on. And we still use the traditional media in a lot of ways, too, to help get the word out, whether it's newspapers, TV, radio, whatever the case may be. But we also like to be able to control the message a little bit ourselves, too, and be able to talk up projects that either we're involved in or the private sector is involved with that's going to make this an even better community, better place to live and work, too.
Rodney Campbell is the spokesman for Marana. He also hosts the town's podcasts.
Coming up, we delve into the controversy surrounding the hunting of wild predators like coyotes and mountain lions.
It's an incredible experience, and it becomes addicting.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. That's coming up in just a few minutes.
KJZZ is supported by Flying E Ranch in Wickenburg, providing an original Western ranch experience as a vacation for families or groups. Carrying on longtime ranch traditions meant to restore your love for the West, FlyingEranch.com.
A group of about 30 people began walking from the San Carlos Apache Reservation to an area in the Tonto National Forest known as Oak Flat today. The 45-mile march begins a four-day protest against the passage of the Southeast Arizona Land Exchange Conservation Act, legislation that transfers about 2,400 acres of Forest Service land to Resolution Copper so they can expand an area copper mine. KJZZ's Carrie Young was at the protest this morning and joins us from San Carlos, Arizona. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, Steve.
So, Carrie, can you give us a little background on the story? Why is the land exchange causing so much tension?
Well, this issue is definitely heated. It's because one of the areas included in the transfer, known as Oak Flat Campground, it's considered sacred to many in the San Carlos Apache tribe. The ground underneath that area, though, it's home to one of the largest copper deposits found in North America. Since 2005, Resolution Copper has been trying to acquire that land through standalone legislation, but it's really never gained enough traction to pass. Last December, that changed, though. Rather than passing the land exchange individually, it was included in the National Defense Authorization Act, which funds military operations and the Department of Defense in general.
Carrie, what was the environment like this morning as the protests got started? As we mentioned in the intro, about 30 people are involved in the march.
Yes, the march got started with about 30 people. There were about 50 people, though, in a gathering just before the march. And at that gathering, there were a few people there giving speeches just to get everyone excited. One of the first to take the mic was Teo Edpison. He was the San Carlos Apache Tribe's vice chair.
The reservation line was created by the U.S. government. That reservation line wasn't created by our ancestors. So Oak Flat belongs to the Native Americans. Oak Flat belongs to the Apaches. So we got to take it back.
So the significance of Oak Flat, as it was explained to me, was that the area has been used almost like a church for generations, like a place to pray. Many in the tribe are arguing that just because the land doesn't fall within the reservation borders doesn't mean it should just be given away like it was.
The march this week is going to be 45 miles long. So what kind of conditions are the protesters going to face?
Well, it's mostly paved roads, and they do have a police escort with them, but the area is sort of mountainous out here, and many sections of U.S. 60, which is where they'll be walking, is narrow. I spoke with two walkers while I was there, Margie Curley and Tremaine Gelson. They didn't seem too concerned about the walk, its length, or its conditions, and they were mostly optimistic that their actions would lead to some change.
And I feel really good about this, and I know something's going to come out of this, what we're doing, you know. It is our right.
I feel like a warrior today, and this is my fight.
KJZZ's Carrie Young with the latest on the San Carlos Apache protest related to the Resolution Copper Mine. Carrie, thanks.
Thank you.
We did reach out to Senators McCain and Flake for an interview earlier this week about the land transfer. Both said they wouldn't be available to talk. In a statement, though, they called the deal a victory for Arizona.
In Iraq, there's a new TV show that takes on the so-called Islamic State. The show features men who are convicted of belonging to the group and involved in their attacks. In weekly episodes, prisoners elaborate on their role in IS, reenact their crimes, and face the families of their victims. But does the show reveal anything about Islamic State? The BBC's Rami Rahayam reports.
Television crew, a security escort, and two convicts make their way through a neighborhood in Baghdad, recently struck by a series of attacks. Residents shout insults from their balconies. At the site of the attack, the convicts reenact the crime. Relatives of the victims approach. Now you're crying, one of them asks. You have no honor, says another. Police gently push them away from the convicts, who remain silent throughout. Away from the drama on the streets, the program features lengthy interviews with the convicts. Meet Abu Jassim, who confessed in detail to working with Islamic State. He looks nervous, keeps his head down, answers briefly. Do you believe in what Islamic State do? The presenter asks. No, he says. They hurt a lot of people. Abu Jassim laments the bloodshed and advises others to think of their futures. The exchange is typical of the interviews with the convicts. There's little insight into their motivations for joining Islamic State.
I'm heading now to the Iraqiya television station to meet Ahmed Hassan, the presenter of the show. I'd like to see what he makes of the convicts he spends so much time with.
Those at the forefront are naive, limited in awareness and knowledge. They are used as fuel. In prison, they reflect on the innocent blood they shed and feel abandoned by Islamic State. They get a reality shock.
Opinion about the program seems split along sectarian lines. It's popular in predominantly Shia areas heavily hit by attacks, but many in Sunni areas are suspicious. The program does not address this gap in perception, but seems oriented towards the aims of a government at war.
The aims are to reassure Iraqis that security forces are hot on the trail of terrorists, to provide guidance to security forces who can learn tricks used by terrorists, to send a message to the judiciary to expedite the sentencing process, to serve justice, and to make anyone thinking of committing crimes reconsider.
But what would make them reconsider, I ask him.
The emotional scenes they are shown and seeing what their future would be like is either death or imprisonment.
On Iraqi TV, they are fragile young men breaking down in remorse. On Islamic State media, they are fearless Puritans marching to victory. In the fog of the media war, the reality behind the images remains as elusive as ever.
That's the BBC's Rami Rahayam.
Starting today, a convention of predator hunters is gathering in Tucson. The group, called Predator Masters, hunts animals like coyotes and raccoons and has drawn national criticism for what critics say amounts to killing contests. The group disputes that term and says it isn't planning an organized hunt during the convention. Still, as KJZZ's Tina Sieg reports, controversy surrounding the sport remains.
That's the sound of a howling coyote, or at least the closest Rich Higgins can get with one of his many breath-powered calling devices.
I truly believe that humans are hardwired genetically as hunter-gatherers, and so we're just being true to our nature.
Higgins is the president of Arizona Predator Callers, one of the many organizations in the state that legally hunts predators, like coyotes, on public land. Higgins says this isn't so much about killing as it is everything else involved with the sport he loves.
Everything from building your own calls and your own howlers, learning the behavior of that animal so that you can exploit its vulnerabilities. All of this is fascinating to us.
And the real point, he says, of what some people call killing contests. That's when hunters like him say you can kill the most coyotes in a certain period of time. Higgins says the reality is many hunters don't even bag a coyote. It's more about hanging out with other people who also enjoy the thrill of the hunt.
It's an incredible experience and becomes addicting.
That doesn't exactly comfort predator hunting opponents who say it's a waste to kill animals without using them for food or fur. Sandy Barr is the president of the Sierra Club's Grand Canyon chapter. She says her organization is not against all hunting, but with some predator hunters,
there is this attitude, which is pretty disrespectful of the animals, that will just, you know, go out and kill as many as possible.
Even if you take away the emotional side of this, Barr says there could be real consequences from this kind of hunting. If the coyote population dips, there could be a large spike, followed by a crash of a prey species coyotes keep in check. On the other hand, coyotes could actually increase in number. Barr says the more they feel threatened,
the more they'll have larger litters, they'll breed earlier, they actually respond by, you know, doing more to build the population.
But the Arizona Game and Fish Department sees it differently.
Under no circumstances in any geographic area have hunters made a dent in the coyote population.
Jim Paxson is the special assistant to the Game and Fish Director. He says there are between 25,000 and 40,000 coyotes in the state. Game and Fish attempted to regulate coyote hunting contests about 15 years ago without success. Now Paxson says the department does not take an official stance. Instead, he says it enforces current rules. Those allow people with valid hunting licenses to kill as many coyotes as they want.
So it's recognized that coyote hunting is a legitimate activity for hunters and sportsmen.
But that doesn't mean it's always easy, even for a seasoned predator hunter like Rich Higgins.
I always have a tinge of regret, always, always, always. And sometimes when it becomes a little bit strong, I will pick up my camera only.
In his heart, Higgins says, he's a hunter. And that's regardless of whether he's hunting coyotes with a lens or a rifle. Stina Sieg, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Still to come, ever wonder what the surface of Pluto looks like? So do planetary scientists.
I suspect we will see landforms that are so weird-looking it takes us quite a while to figure out what they are, how they got that way, what kind of timescales are involved.
Waiting on photos from the dwarf planet, that's ahead. It's the show.
It is indeed the show on 91.5 with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Sunny skies and 78 degrees at 2:33.
KJZZ is supported by SRP, providing over 150 education grants last year to schools in our community, creating a foundation for future scientists, engineers, technicians, and tradespeople. More at srp4edu.com.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Secretary of State John Kerry says President Obama will decide soon whether to provide defensive weapons to Ukraine. But Kerry says the U.S. still prefers a diplomatic solution to the crisis there.
All we're asking is that Russia and the separatists support and honor the commitments that they made. that they implement a real ceasefire.
Kerry speaking in Kiev with Ukraine's prime minister at his side. France and Germany have proposed a new plan to end the fighting in eastern Ukraine, a move that seems aimed at heading off any U.S. decision to provide Ukraine with lethal weapons, which Europeans fear could worsen the situation there. Jordan's military says dozens of its warplanes have bombed and destroyed targets linked to the so-called Islamic State. The attacks came after the militants killed a Jordanian pilot. Jordan State TV showed pilots scribbling messages on the missiles they would fire. One of the messages read, "For you, the enemies of Islam." President Obama is making an appeal for religious freedom as he quoted from the Bible, the Torah, and the Quran at the National Prayer Breakfast today. NPR's Scott Horsley reports among those attending was the Dalai Lama.
President Obama used the prayer breakfast to criticize extremists like the so-called Islamic State, who claim to be standing up for their faith, but who are in fact, he said, distorting it. He appealed for religious tolerance and pluralism, both at home and around the world.
I believe that the starting point of faith is some doubt. Not being so full of yourself and so confident that you are right and that God speaks only to us.
Obama pointed to the Dalai Lama as a powerful example of compassion and religious freedom. The government of China had discouraged Obama from appearing in public with the exiled Tibetan leader. Scott Horsley, NPR News, the White House.
This is NPR.
KJZZ is supported by the University of Arizona Eller MBA, with two programs for working professionals in downtown Phoenix and a 100% online option. Details about the Thursday, February 12th info session at ellerembA.com.
This is KJZZ. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. For the first time in history, there are now more than 100 seats in Congress occupied by women, with 84 in the House and 20 in the Senate. But while the 2014 election put more women in Congress, the Republican takeover of the Senate actually means fewer women are in leadership positions.
Cheryl Gay Stolberg, Washington correspondent for The New York Times, has been covering this topic.
In the House, five of the elected 10 Republican Party leaders are women, but there's only one female committee chair in the House and only two in the Senate. And it's the committees where, as you know, Congress does its real work, the work of writing laws.
Is that purely a function of seniority, or is it something to do with the style of the GOP?
No, it is really a function of seniority. It's seniority in both parties. The Senate is an institution that relies on seniority. Longevity matters. And when you've been around a long time, you can rise to the position of a powerful committee chair. Democratic women tend to have been elected earlier and in larger numbers than Republican women. And so when Democrats ran the Senate, women rose up, and there were 9 women chairing committees under the Democratic-controlled Senate. As I said, that's down to 2 now.
Among them, Barbara Mikulski, who was a veteran senator from the state of Maryland, a former chair of the Senate Appropriations Committee. How does her tenure in appropriations going to compare, do you think, with Thad Cochran of Mississippi?
Well, you know, it used to be said of Barbara Mikulski that the Appropriations Committee members respected their previous male chairman, but they feared Barbara Mikulski. Barbara Mikulski is a very tough Maryland Democrat. She was on that committee for a long time, and she, you know, she wielded power in a very sharp and tough way. I think it's too soon to tell how her tenure will compare with the much more genteel and soft-spoken Thad Cochran from Mississippi. But for women, seeing Barbara Mikulski lose that appropriations chair was very difficult for Democratic women.
And let's just remind ourselves of the intensity of Barbara Mikulski. Here she is speaking.
Now, I'll tell you what I'm tired of hearing, that somehow or another we're too emotional when we talk. You know, when we raise an issue, we're too emotional. Well, I am emotional. I am so emotional about this. I am telling you, if we don't pass this bill, I'm so emotional, I'm going to press on.
I gather we can expect some of that same passion from Republican Lisa Murkowski, the new chair of the Senate Energy Committee.
As the ranking member on the Energy Committee, I'm always looking for good energy policy. This delay from the Obama administration of the Keystone XL pipeline is not good energy policy. This is bad energy policy. This is politics.
We've already seen Murkowski take on the White House over federal lands in the Arctic.
Well, yes, and that clip that you played was from when Senator Murkowski was, as she said in it, the ranking member. Now she's the chairwoman. Mm-hmm. She's already gotten the Keystone Pipeline bill to pass the Senate. She's really probably the most powerful female committee chair in the Senate. Of course, there are only two. The other is Susan Collins of Maine, who had been in the past the Homeland Security chair during George W. Bush's presidency. Susan Collins told me an interesting story about that time when Donald Rumsfeld, the defense secretary, came to testify before her committee. She said she looked to the left and she looked to the right and she realized there were no women on the dais. And then she looked down at the witness table where there was Rumsfeld and about four other witnesses, and none of them were women. And all of a sudden she thought to herself, hey, but I'm in charge here.
What can we expect from Collins in her new assignment?
We'll see her as a force on the committee chair, but more importantly of Senator Collins, she's been somebody who exemplifies a trait that people say women in the Senate generally exemplify, and that is bipartisanship.
Cheryl Gay Stolberg, Washington correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. Thanks so much, Cheryl.
Thank you.
That's The Takeaways, John Hockenberry.
The southern Arizona town of Tubac has started using a new currency. It's actually an old currency, and it's not meant to replace dollars, but it is meant to attract visitors and attention to the town, which bills itself as where history and art meet. Ivan Draxler owns the Tubac Country Inn and says the new currency went into circulation a few weeks ago.
We were looking to do a cross of Bitcoin and social media, and something that would be a unifier of the community and a method to highlight our history and art, and also to start a new conversation channel. So we wanted to create this media campaign, and in order to do the unity piece, we didn't want it to have any specific value, but we wanted to have it out there as being a currency that we replicated from the 1850s that was existent here in Tubac. So I was able to go back, and I went over to talk to Shaw Kingsley at the Tubac Presidio State Historic Park, and we uncovered an actual currency that was existent at that time.
So are these coins? Are they paper money? What is it?
We actually put the correct size, the 2x3, on the pasteboard and replicated the actual front of the currency that we had the pictures of.
And what denominations do you have?
Well, the idea is that the denomination is made up by the merchant, the participating merchant. Whatever that person wants to do is what that will be. So it's trying to encourage a discussion and a engagement with the people coming into Tubac. We decided to let the merchants choose what they would like to do. It could be a discount. It could be an add-on situation. It could be something physical that they give to you.
So if I go to a store and buy something and it costs $3, let's say, and I hand over one of these item units of currency, the merchant could say, okay, this will pay for all of it, this will pay for half of it, this will pay for some other percentage of it?
Or also it could be that they give you something in exchange, in addition to the purchase that you're making.
How much participation do you have in this? I mean, how many merchants in town are accepting these?
68.
Is that a big percentage of the merchants that are in Tubac?
Oh, yes, absolutely, yeah.
How does one get one of these items of currency to begin with?
Well, the fun thing about it is that you go to the Tubac Presidio State Historic Park or the Tubac Center of the Arts and sign in and get your dinero.
You don't have to pay for it?
No.
So basically it sounds like people who do that are essentially getting stuff for free then.
Correct.
So how do merchants not lose money on that?
Well, the idea is that did they have this person in front of them before regardless? The idea is to encourage new people's awareness of Tubac.
So a potential maybe short-term loss for longer-term gain?
Correct. And we're also looking at attracting the China, the Brazil, the Canadian, Mexican, France, England, Germany international play, where they would find attractive this type of promotion and feature, and it gets them thinking of the history of Tubac. It's a fun thing. It's something that the merchants can have fun engaging the people who come with the Bolero Dinero, and it also ties that history, and it moves the art forward.
Ivan Drexler owns and operates the Tubac Country Inn. You can see a photo of the Bolero Dinero at KJZZ.org. The director of the State Corrections Department this week started pitching lawmakers on a new 3,000-bed private prison. That plan was met with skepticism from some legislators on both sides of the aisle, but State Senator John Kavanaugh, a Fountain Hills Republican, was not one of them.
I support it because it promotes public safety, it will relieve current overcrowding in our prison system, and it will save the taxpayers money. In fact, we can't afford to build a prison ourselves because we could never get the capital together to do that. And when you contract with a private company, they build the prison and there's no upfront cost for the state. And on top of that, the actual daily rate per prisoner that they charge, even taking into account that they're doing the construction also, is still lower than the cost of a prisoner in a state-run facility. And if all of that weren't enough, at the end of the contract, which is usually 20 to 25 years, the private prisons turn the prison over to the state. They keep operating it, usually, at an even lower per diem rate. So it's a win-win-win for the taxpayers.
The Department of Corrections puts out reports looking at comparisons between private and state-run prisons. And I want to ask you about this cost element, because in the most recent DOC report, it looked at the adjusted costs of private versus state-run prisons, adjusting for things that private prisons don't do, like maximum security and some of the higher health needs. And it found, the report found, that in minimum custody prisons that the state and private basically cost the same per diem, and in medium security the state prisons were actually $5 cheaper per day. So that's not true.
And the corrections department director mentioned the statistics at the hearing several days ago. This myth about public prisons being equal or cheaper is a myth. They were putting that in their report for years, but they were not factoring in to the cost of the public prisons the construction costs, and other services like legal services, the Attorney General, the Procurement Department, and even more of a problem, they weren't funding in the massive unfunded pension costs that they're going to have to pay in the future to make whole the poorly, poorly underfunded correctional office's pension system. And when the Joint Legislative Budget Committee, at the direction of the Appropriations Committee, put those factors in, for the medium and low security prisons, the private prisons were cheaper, and they didn't even take into account the fact that we get gifted the prison at the end of the contract term.
How will the state do as far as the types of prisoners that it expects to be locking up down the road? That we're looking at basically medium and minimum security prisoners here, not maximum security prisoners, not prisoners who maybe have extensive health needs, things like that.
There's two reasons. Well, the main reason why is because the Department of Corrections are the ones who do the estimates, and they claim that that is where the need will be. And part of that, by the way, is the fact that that's where the need is now.
State Senator John Kavanaugh of Fountain Hills.
The Grand Canyon Institute, a Valley-based think tank, released a statement this week criticizing Governor Ducey's private prison budget proposal. Dave Wells is the group's research director. He says the state's leaders need to reassess their priorities.
We incarcerate too many people. Incarceration is very expensive. It costs $20,000 for minimum security folks. And we could move a lot of those folks who the DOC already thinks are ultra low risk of recidivism to community probation with supervision for less than $5,000 a person, save taxpayers a lot of money, and get better outcomes. I think people are not fully aware that this is a $1.5 billion over two decades deal, because these are usually 20-year contracts. It's sort of like a mortgage on a house.
Well, and sentencing reform was something that had some support a few years ago. Remember Cecil Ash, when he was in the legislature, didn't really go anywhere. How much of a difference would that make, and what kind of reform do you think, at least from a budget standpoint, would make sense?
Arizona is the only state in the whole country that actually has what they call truth in sentencing for nonviolent offenders. And that means people have not committed a violent offense, but they have to serve at least 85% of their sentence behind bars. Nothing they can do can change that. What most states are moving to is something called earned release, which gives inmates incentives to engage in drug treatment, education, vocational programs, cognitive behavioral programs, and if they behave themselves in prison. And if they do those things, then they can reduce their sentences, maybe perhaps like in half. And then they still have the sentence, but they're in supervised probation, which costs, as I indicated, much less, about $5,000 or less per inmate, as opposed to paying $20,000 or more. And they're not even usually getting drug treatment.
When we look at what the state is spending money on, are you as concerned as many others are about how K-12 funding is in relation to prison spending?
As well as universities. I think there's a clear change in our priorities. You've noticed, if you look over the last 10 to 15 years, you'll notice that the spending on K-12 has, I mean, they fudged the formula and they've got in courts because they're not willing to do that. But at the same time, there seems to be no reluctance to always fund Department of Corrections no matter what they ask for. And meanwhile, you know, the economy is supposed to be doing relatively well, and universities are being asked to take a $75 million hit on top of what was essentially their funding has been cut in half over the last half decade. And that talks to you about the state's priorities. I think the priorities ought to be, and most people agree, on education. That's how we improve our economic base and our growth rate. Prisons isn't the way to do that.
Do you think a report like this is something that will open people's eyes more to asking more tough questions about what the priorities for the budget are?
Yes, I think so. And I was really encouraged by a number of the Republican members of the Appropriations Committee, people like Debbie Lesko and Sylvia Allen and Kelly Ward, who actually asked some tough questions to Chuck Ryan, the director of the corrections. And I think that's important, because I think we need to have a really good public discussion, because too often in Arizona, we just make ideological policy decisions. I mean, we can't even anymore evaluate whether private or public owned facilities are cheaper for prisons, because the legislature got rid of that law. And it's really important to make really evidence-based decisions. And everything I've been talking about are evidence-based policies that other states are engaged in that have been shown to work and to save money. And also, I mean, it helps inmates, you know, be able to integrate into society better.
Dave Wells is research director for the Grand Canyon Institute.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. He's Steve. I'm Mark. Couple traffic problems to let you know about. I-17 northbound at 16th Street. There's a disabled vehicle blocking two lanes there. Also, I-10 westbound at 7th Street. An accident blocks the right lane. Sunny skies, 78 degrees at KJZZ at 252.
KJZZ is supported by Mesa Art Center's Valentine's Day with Molly Ringwald. February 14th, a romantic evening of cocktails, gourmet food, and music, benefiting community arts programs through the Mesa Arts Foundation. MesaArtsCenter.com.
I'm not a fan of clowns, and avoiding hospitals also seems like a good idea, but not everyone agrees on that. For one Valley clown and self-proclaimed giggle therapist, it's just another day's work. The show's Annika Klein brings us more of this funny business.
What's your name?
Julie Varholt is not Julie Varholt today.
Well, I'm nice to meet you. I am Lovely Buttons. Hello.
Varholt, a.k.a. Lovely Buttons, is volunteering in the pediatric unit at the Maricopa Medical Center.
You don't have any fish in your fish tank. Would you like some fish to put in your fish tank?
The fish tank is actually an IV bag hanging next to one child's hospital bed. Lovely Buttons puts a fish sticker on it.
There you go. Now you have a fish and he's smiling at you.
It's hard not to think of Robin Williams' character in Patch Adams as you watch Varholt. She performs tricks that make the hospital just melt away.
Yeah, I see you got one of those light-up fingers. Is it working?
The light-up finger she's talking about is actually a pulse oximeter. That's the clip on a patient's finger that measures blood pulse and oxygen content. But for Lovely Buttons, it's a magic light that she can hold in her hand. She pulls the red light off the child's finger and holds it on her own. Now her finger is lit, too.
Wow, did you know that comes off of there? Look at that. Check it out, the light.
But it's not always easy to play pretend at the hospital. Here's Varholt out of character.
It was really hard to do at first because it takes you about 4 or 5 visits to where you're not crying anymore. Yeah, and some people can do it, some people can't.
Varholt has been volunteering here for 11 years and clowning for 23. She also teaches clown classes online and in person to new and seasoned clowns. Yes, if you're wondering, there is such a thing as clown school. It might not take as many years as med school, but there are plenty of lessons to learn.
like this one.
You can't be your regular people self when you're in clown. You need to be somebody else.
Especially here, where there's plenty of medicine, and what kids need instead is a little bit of magic.
Oh, good, it's squeaks. Push on it, make sure I didn't break it. Uh-oh, I broke it. I'm sorry. Here, listen. I broke it again. Okay, you're doing it. Okay, now push on.
It's the show. I'm Anika Klein.
That's crazy. Okay, oop, wait a minute. Now, wait a second. How'd I do that?
NASA's New Horizons spacecraft has released a kind of tease, the first photos from its mission to Pluto. You probably wouldn't know it was Pluto by looking at it. The photo shows two white blobs in a dark sky. But those pictures will come more into focus and with higher resolution as the craft gets closer to the dwarf planet, probably by late May or early June. The mission launched in early 2006. Will Grundy, a planetary scientist at Lowell Observatory in Flagstaff and co-investigator on the New Horizons team, says it'll be a slow reveal of pictures.
It's been a long way in transit. We're on Pluto's doorstep, we could say. We've got about something like almost 3 billion miles in the rearview mirror and only 120 million to go. 120 million sounds like a lot, but we're knocking down another 5.5 million miles every week, so we're moving right along.
So one of the things that seems to be generating the most excitement is the possibility of actually seeing what Pluto looks like. What do you think it's going to look like?
Yeah, it's an exciting prospect. I mean, humanity really is in for a huge treat this year because we're going to get the first look at a whole new class of world. Every time we see some whole new class of world for the first time, we are just overwhelmed by all of the surprises that we see, and I'm sure it will be the same. I really don't know what to expect. I mean, I can work by analogy and talk about sort of similar objects elsewhere in the solar system that we have seen, like, you know, Neptune's large moon Triton or some of the icy satellites of the other icy satellites of the giant planets. But we don't really know what to expect. I suspect we will see landforms that are so weird looking it takes us quite a while to figure out what they are, how they got that way, what kind of timescales are involved.
Do you have a picture in your head of what you might expect?
Yeah. But it's all by analogy, you know. It's not based on knowledge because we haven't got that knowledge yet. So, for instance, I look at Triton, I see cantaloupe terrain, which is named, it's a descriptive name because that's sort of what it looks like, is the skin of a cantaloupe. Yeah, sure, maybe we could have cantaloupe terrain on Pluto. Or you see geysers squirting off on Triton's southern hemisphere. Sure, maybe we could have some geysers on Pluto. Saturn's largest moon, Titan, has a dune field, so maybe we could have sand dunes of some sort. I can picture different kinds of landforms, and maybe we would have those. But more interesting than speculating about what we're going to see, I think it's considering what capabilities we bring to the game, because the spacecraft has a more sophisticated instrument suite than anything that's ever flown on one of these first reconnaissances, and that's just simply a function of the technology improving over time.
So what do you think that you'll be able to tell about Pluto based just on the photos that you get back from this mission?
Yeah, so we'll get photos, black and white photos with quite high resolution and color photos with slightly lower resolution. And I think we will see all kinds of interesting and wild and crazy landforms and also familiar ones like craters and faults and things that are more familiar. But the one capability that I'm most excited about is that we have an imaging spectrometer aboard. And what that gives you is a map of what everything is made out of. So you take an observation of a scene and, you know, a color camera will give you the color of each pixel, but we will get the composition of each pixel. Effectively, we'll get a map of what everything is made out of. And when we're trying to figure out how some completely baffling-looking landform was made, what kind of processes built it, knowing what it's made out of is a huge boost in figuring that out.
Will Grundy is a planetary scientist at Lowell Observatory in Flagstaff and co-investigator on the New Horizons team.
It's the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
Welcome to Art Link's First Friday Trolley. My name is Brooks. I'm your volunteer host, and this is Elizabeth, your fantastic driver for the evening.
My name is Brooks Warner. I'm the volunteer coordinator for Art Link Phoenix.
Check. Can everybody hear me in the back? How about a show of hands for how many people have never been to First Friday in downtown Phoenix? Yay. Fantastic. I'd like to see that.
On the busiest nights of the year, there are up to 20,000 people that attend First Friday. A lot of families, a lot of out-of-towners.
Bakersfield. Wow, you came a long way.
Orange County.
Woo!
There's so many great things going down on Roosevelt Row and on Grand Avenue, and I'm friends with so many people that have galleries, and so I do my best every night to hit all of them.
Anyone interested in the biggest First Friday in the United States of America, please get off here.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Have fun. Thank you again. Thank you. Have fun.
That was Brooks Werner. He hosts one of the ArtLink trolleys every first Friday of the month in downtown Phoenix. You can visit him tomorrow night at First Friday. And if you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix, or if you just think we're a little bit too abstract, send us a note, the show at kjzz.org.
Reminder, on the Valley freeways, there is an accident on I-10 westbound at 7th Street. It has the right lanes blocked back up to about 19th Avenue. On the eastbound side, the freeway, you have slowing from